Well, I just love everything about Mary Roach. I have really no business claiming her as a friend, but I do anyway, and have for years, pretty much behind her back, I think. Only met her once in person, but her regular appearances on Coast to Coast are epic, and I'm so grateful that she made time for us tonight, despite the fact that, as I understand it, from a conversation we were having earlier this morning, she was really very much in need last night of the cat police. We'll start there when we talk about Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law, the latest book from America's funniest science writer, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Oh, where to begin with you, Mary Roach, other than our gratitude for your returning on Coast to Coast AM?
Oh, I wouldn't miss it. It's so lovely to be back.
And I know you're a little tired because of a wildlife encounter. Let's start there.
Well, it was actually more of a domestic animal encounter, but this is an animal that was in the middle of the night, trespassing, vandalizing, and disturbing the peace, specifically my peace. Ed was down working in his workshop, and the door was open, and somebody's cat got in, and Ed locked the door, and so this cat had been, I don't know whose cat, had been in there for, 7 or 8 hours, and was beginning to panic, and sometime around 11, the noises started, and we're like, what is that? It must be a raccoon, I don't know.
Right.
It'd be like every 20 minutes it would come back and make more noise. Finally, I put on my slippers and my bathrobe, and I went out, and I figured out that this cat was in the basement, I don't know, shaking the rafters or something. that was about 2 a.m.
You up. But I'll push back on the idea that that's not wildlife. It's not, if it's not your cat, it's wildlife, right? I mean, there's lots of people who might own a cougar, but it's their cougar. As soon as it gets out of that enclosure, it's wildlife again.
That is true. It's wildlife breaking the law.
Yeah.
I know all about it.
Yeah. Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law, is the new book. And I love the quote that you have, at least on your website, America's funniest science writer. How big is that convention every year when you get together with the...
Yeah. 20 or so.
Okay.
People, maybe. Yeah. So,
maybe.
Not saying much to be American.
Yeah.
The bar is pretty low.
I mean, there's lots of things you are. You are America's tallest female science writer.
That could well be, yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
You are. I mean, there's, when we start looking at that kind of categorization.
I'm probably America's oldest female science writer.
There you go. Funniest science writer emeritus of some sort, or
something like that. I don't even know if I'm a science writer. Am I?
Yeah, you are. You are. And here's why I know this. So this is why, as I mentioned in my little preamble before you came on, it happens at least once a year when I'm teaching that somebody will mention your name, and they will say, because I ask every media class I teach, what are your goals? What do you want to do? Where do you see yourself fitting in the media sphere? There's a lot more STEM kind of conversations that go on now than ever before, and especially embraced by what are, almost regardless of age, referred to as STEM girls. And so they're very unabashed about their dedication to the sciences in all sorts of different forms, mathematics, engineering, whatever. And they're wanting to write about it or report on it. And so somebody will mention your name and they'll say, yeah, I kind of want to be like a science writer, kind of like, I don't know if you know the name Mary Roach. And I'll say, and I always say, regardless of whether it's true, you can pull my fingernails out, I'll still say it, is I say, oh, she's a friend of mine. And they're just amazed. Yes, yeah, but they're like, you know Mary Roach? And so you have that kind of awe with this upcoming group. And I think we're looking at a couple generations now of would-be female science reporters and contributors, observers. And that's why I know you are a science writer, because those are the people that are attracted to following the model that you set for them.
Okay, I will take your word for it. Well, that's lovely to hear. You know why that is? I think because somehow Stiff, my first book, Stiff, got onto this magical list of summer reading for high school students. I don't know who's the keeper of this sacred list of, here's some of the reading you'll be doing this summer.
Right.
But my book somehow landed on that list. And whoever keeps the list doesn't change it very often. So young people keep reading that book. So, and that's been nice.
Well, and anyway. I think that, and I want to get, I understand there's an update on that. I will say that's probably the librarians from high schools and junior high schools.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and they can tell what gets checked out a lot, and they could see the market for that, just probably on the end. And Stiff is such a hoot. Anyway, I still remember the night we talked about all the aspects of Stiff. So that doesn't surprise me. But do you have a new edition?
Yeah, we just my publisher is redoing the look of my backlist, meaning the books that came out before, and Stiff is the first one they redid. It's got a snazzy new cover. I like it very much. So, we didn't change the text, but there's an epilogue at the end. So I just, it was during COVID, so I couldn't go anywhere. So I just got on the phone with a lot of people like, hey, what's been happening in the past, whatever, how many years, quite a few years since that book came out, and just sort of updated all things new and exciting with cadavers.
Well, and if for people that are Coast insiders and they can go back and they can listen to shows on Coast to Coast, I highly recommend that one. And so Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law, though, you were obviously on the road for this one. Because you are there as things are happening. And I try to describe it as saying some of what you investigate is the collision between humans and animals from a governmental perspective, and then there's lots of non-governmental research going on to try to address some of the specific problems. As you look at it, what's the meta theme for the encounters between humans and animals these days?
The meta theme. Well,
yeah. What ties it all together?
The thing is, we and people in the business tend to refer to them as nuisance animals or problem animals or conflict animals. But the solutions are rarely lie in changing the behavior of the animal. It's mostly, gets down to changing the behavior of the or the outlook of the humans. And a lot of times the humans kind of create the problem in the first place. But the book is organized, by crime. So I start with the felonies. So we have murder and manslaughter and home invasion and breaking and entering. And then we move on to the misdemeanors.
Yeah.
Vandalism, jaywalking. And animals do all of that. Obviously, the laws are written for people. Animals, they're just being animals. They're looking for something to eat or a place to build a nest. Then they happen to be doing it on our property, and it pisses us off.
Yeah, and who can blame us for feeling victimized? But that, again, is the story that's told by the dominant culture, right? I mean, that we tell our own story. Be very interesting to see if we really could ever recover the stories that are told by bears, how they look at what what the encounter is, right? But so if I had the meta theme, I would say it's that it certainly is our encroachment further and further into nature. That's nothing new. But I think it is just, you hit on it there. It's our lack of awareness. Some communities have it, and you get to that in the book. But they don't always live by the very smart rules that they create of these attractive nuisances. We wouldn't have nuisance bears if we weren't creating attractive nuisances for them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. People say, well, seems pretty simple. Why don't you just have bear resistant garbage containers?
Right.
And I spent some time in Aspen. And you can't believe how complicated it gets. Yes, they have those resistant containers, but I spent some time at 3 a.m. in the alley behind where the restaurants are in Aspen. And I'm like, yeah, let's go check it out. I doubt we'll see anything. The researcher and I, we show up at 3:30 a.m. Within 2 minutes, we're looking down this alley. There's a big garbage bag split open. And Stuart, the researcher, is like, let's just hang out here for a little bit. They'll probably be back. And then within 5 minutes, this black bear comes back. Anyway, so we were wandering up and down the alleys like, this container has a broken lock. The public is throwing their food scraps into the recycling container, which doesn't have to be locked. Up in the hills, you have a lot of vacation rentals. People come from out of town. They don't know anything about bears. They don't give a crap, so they don't bother to lock it. There's very little enforcement of the laws. You know, they're like, yeah, plus you've got six condos in a condo building and one dumpster. How are you going to prove who gets the fine? Who left it open? So it's like, you would think it'd be easy. And it should be. Just don't leave something out that they want. You know, and I love this. The guy I was traveling around with, he literally wrote the paper on bears breaking into cars and minivans in Yosemite. He wrote a journal paper about it. And so he knows that you never leave anything in the car that a bear wants. I just talked to him a couple of weeks ago. He said, you won't believe it. I left a peach in the car in the Cascades, and a bear broke into my car. His car. I mean, the man who wrote the paper. So, I mean, I don't mean to, berate people too much.
But that's what it is. It's because bears have just this highly tuned olfactory response to even something like the nubs of French fries that fall in between seats that kids don't eat.
Exactly. Yeah, that's why it's like, and he was doing this project. He's like, it's minivans. They're always breaking into minivans. They go right for the minivan. And he's like, is it because there's some flaw in how the minivan door is engineered?
No.
It's because minivans are full of children, and children are dropping crumbs and spilling juice.
Yeah.
And it's a minivan. Trash. Yeah.
And I love the fact that the bears can recognize right away. They get the outline of a minivan. They know, they can tell the difference between what kind of cars have the food. They don't even have to smell it. They just start by looking, going, oh, there's a minivan. Let's start there.
Yeah. When I was in, spending some time with this woman who's kind of the bear enforcement lady in Snowmass, which is a ski resort area. She said that the bears in Pitkin County, it's Aspen, it's pretty ritzy. She said they go straight for the premium ice cream brands. They will not touch, apparently Western Family ice cream is the cheap kind of generic ice cream. She said they will not touch Western Family ice cream. They go for the Ben and Jerry's.
But Ben and Jerry's. Right, you got to go for the premium stuff because they're not going to waste their time on that. The kind of very sort of thing my parents would have bought for us is not good enough for bears.
Yeah, same here.
I wish I'd known that then. I would have made that argument to my parents about this. Yes, doesn't even say ice cream. It says ice milk. This isn't ice cream. It says ice milk. All right. So since you structured it along the way of felonies, let's talk about about murdering animals, animals who kill, because that really is an issue. And we have lots of different animals out there. Who's the biggest offender when it comes to animal human murder?
Snakes, actually. I didn't talk about snakes, but snakes kill more people. Snakes kill about, in the United States, let's look at just the United States right now, about 15 people a year. Dogs, similar, the fatal dog attacks. And then way down, you get to bears, between 0 and 3 people killed by bears every year. So even though, you know, it makes huge headlines when a bear kills someone, not so much when a snake kills someone. Those are the numbers. Mountain lions, way less. I mean, we in California, we have about 5,000 mountain lions, but a decade will go by before anybody, you know, with nobody being fatally attacked by a mountain lion.
Do you think that's because the snake doesn't eat the person? And when bears do kill, they tend to eat?
I think it's because, I think bears and snakes are both usually attacking when they feel threatened, when they're, you know, it's like a defensive thing. Bears are eating nuts and berries, and they're like old hippies. You know, they're not interested in eating us. I mean, they will snack on, if they come across a dead person in the woods, they might
right.
Slow down. They might have a taste, but they're not, you know, stalking us and killing us for a meal. And snakes, I think just because people step on them or they reach in somewhere.
Right.
It's kind of amazing that many people are killed by snakes.
But yet there's a lot of research to try to come between humans and bear contact. And I thought that part was very compelling, that there are a lot of people. This is what they do, you know, it's a full-time job, is
yes.
research
yes.
bears.
They've got names like job titles like bear manager, which I love. It's kind of this combination of kind of mid-level bureaucrat
right.
and wildlife.
Right.
You know, like, well, I'm in middle management now. I'm hoping to be senior bear manager if I play
right.
my cards right.
yeah,
I'm hoping for a promotion.
And it sounds a little bit too like the bears are wearing like short sleeve shirts with pocket protectors too. Like,
right.
They're part of the
yeah.
process. They're in
exactly bear manager.
They're in the structure.
Exactly.
They have a bear promotion program that they're working on to get more bears integrated into the management, because it's just better that way. If you have, it's better for everybody
yeah.
if more bears are involved in the management of other bears. It looks
and
the optics
yeah.
are better.
Exactly. And they're good at running the meetings, you know?
Yeah. But this is where, I mean, I loved the research on protecting people from bears. And you mentioned, you know, that some of these garbage cans, but it comes right down to is some communities are better at that than others. And you can write laws all day long that encourage people to do better when it comes to the disposal or,
yes.
or the protection of. But a lot of these communities, they think it's funny. They like having bears around, right? I mean, or at least they may not officially.
They don't have, you know, I talked to the guy in the Aspen Police Department. Okay, Aspen doesn't have a whole lot of crime. It's
right.
pretty tidy, well-to-do community. So they got one guy who's handling 17 different things, like, you know, they have traffic violations and roadkill on the side of the road, and you name it. He's got this very kind of hodgepodge job, and to that has been added enforcement of bear resistant containers and restaurants that are violating that rule, and homeowners.
Right.
And he doesn't really have time to do it. But when people do enforce the rules, like in that town, the other town I was mentioning,
right.
it makes a huge difference. You know, something like there's a study where they looked at the over, I don't know what the span of time was, but in communities where they had 80% compliance, like everybody does it right, there's like double digits, like 40 maybe complaints over the span. And in the community where only 10% of people bothered to do it, there were hundreds
yeah.
of bear conflicts. So it does help, but it's somebody's got to enforce it.
Yep.
She said that people in the community call her and her partner the bear bitches.
Yeah, and they kind of both fear and respect them, and we need more
yeah.
of them. When you read
right.
this book, we'll talk more with Mary Roach coming up, but let me just say again, Fuzz, when nature breaks the law is will change the way you look at the nature that's around you. And I'll get you another example of that, because as Mary said, the book is designed from like the worst offenders down to things like jaywalking. And we'll get to that when bears they take a big part of the first part, but there's a lot more animals to cover. And we will coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So you can hear the theme here, right? The idea of when nature breaks the law. Who are we to set laws for nature? We have, of course, natural laws, but are we observing those? So if nature were to write laws for us, what would those look like? Besides, most of our laws that we write for wildlife are fairly futile. And it's not just domestic. That's the cool thing about the new book, Fuzz, from Mary Roach, is what we think of. I mean, we're talking about our bear problem. What about an elephant problem? And what about man-eating leopards? When and how does a leopard become a man-eater? We'll do that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So part of me, as I'm reading this book, and I'm looking like an idiot, because half the time I'm reading this book, I'm sitting by myself somewhere, and I'll laugh out loud, and then people look at me funny. But that's just the way it is when you read Mary Roach. But part of this was sort of a greater awareness of nature, and the problems that we face are pretty minor compared to what other countries have to deal with. You know, we got a lot of stuff going on here, and the occasional moose attack or something from a large animal. Nothing like an elephant. We'll pick that up. So let's talk about the elephants and how they fit in terms of, you think like the last person you'd be able, the last thing you'd be able to write a law for would be an elephant, because they wouldn't, they're not going to really care.
They're not going to care. No. Elephants, I don't know. When I was a kid, I read The Bar.
Oh yeah.
Or Dumbo.
Right.
Or National Geographic. You know, I just thought of elephants as they were, in fact, my favorite animal as a kid. They kind of big, bumbling, kind of gentle.
Happy to be there. Gentle plant eaters.
Exactly. Right. 500 people a year in India are killed by elephants. And that just blew my mind. I spent time in India traveling around with this researcher from the Wildlife Institute of India, and he goes around in the north of India to villages where there's a lot of conflicts with elephants. What happens is the elephants move across the north of India over the course of a year. They kind of migrate looking for food, and they tend to get sort of stuck when, say, a military installation is erected or a road is put in, kind of this corridor gets broken up. And so the elephants get stuck in an area and there's not enough food. I mean, an elephant eats a lot of food. Forget the number of pounds. It's in the book.
Right,
it's a large, large salad that they're eating every day. And they're big animals. So they turn to the villagers' crops. And this tends to be at night. And you can imagine if you're a villager and you've been growing, cauliflower and rice, and you've been taking care of it, and all of a sudden, like, 10 elephants come through. First of all, just walking through, they're going to destroy a lot of it.
Right.
And then they eat a bunch of it. So the villagers start, they'll run out into the field, and it's nighttime, and they're yelling, and maybe they've got firecrackers or they've got a torch. And the group of elephants sort of panics, and they split up, which makes them really nervous and unstable. They're happier in a group. And people sometimes have been drinking. And as my mother liked to say, somebody's going to get hurt. People get trampled. They get stepped on. They get knocked over. And it happens with surprising frequency. So what this researcher's been doing is putting together, getting communities to put together an elephant response team. And these are people that someone in the village has heard that there's elephants in the area or that they're heading their way, it's like calling 911 for elephants.
Right.
They call
the
elephant response team, and these guys come out in their SUV, and they kind of herd the elephants away from the farmland in a vehicle. They don't run out.
Right. With firecrackers.
Pajamas with firecrackers. Right. So that is a better way to go about it. I mean, obviously, the best thing would be to not build roadways and installations and housing developments kind of blocking these animals. But it's tough. You know, India is a very populous country. There's a lot of refugees coming in from Nepal and Bangladesh up there. So it's a lot of conflict.
Yeah, you remind me too. Yeah. That's the whole. That's not just. I mean, isn't India where pajamas were invented?
I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. So when they go out in their, I mean, I just thought that's actually everybody's got pajamas in India. That's kind of what you're supposed to wear, I think.
That's your heritage. Right.
I'll have to ask my friend from India that he grew up with a better understanding of the need of pajamas. I want to get back to this because what is the actual right that people have in India to get elephants out of their small farmland or, you know, from stopping them from eating the crops on their own? Are they obligated to have to call this elephant response team?
They're not obligated to. It's just it's a smart thing to do. I'll tell you, I saw a news story while I was there about a man who was killed in an elephant situation, and it said that he'd been drinking, for one thing, and then he ran from his house, and the eyewitness said he confronted them himself. Okay, them was 18 elephants. So this man did not. This man did not survive.
He didn't do math.
No.
The reason I asked that question was because my barber killed a bear once when I lived in Minnesota, which is at the only place I think we ever actually met in person. Right, was in like St. Paul or something.
That is correct. Yeah, St. Paul.
But my barber had a cabin, as people are inclined to have in Minnesota, and he was surrounded by bears. And there are, as you say, there are a lot of laws about, you know, this intersection between human and wildlife. And he had a bear which was not could not be categorized as a nuisance bear. It wasn't eating his garbage, he wasn't doing, but he seemed to have developed an interest in getting into the cabin, no matter whether there were humans inside or not, and he would just not be repelled. And he had to, my friend, my barber at the time, said that he was so reluctant to shoot this bear, but his kids were inside because he knew it would be, he said it was easier to shoot a person who was trying to get into your house. There would be less of an investigation if it were a person trying to break in your house than if it were a bear. And he had to take pictures. He had to prove himself innocent of bearicide or whatever they called it. When if that had been a person, everyone would have looked and said, that was wrong.
Right. Predicide, I think they call it.
Is that what they call it? Yeah.
Well, for a predator. Is a bear really a predator? In some instances. Well, yeah, I mean, I forget if it's, I think it may be Michigan. There are some states where basically, I think it's Michigan, where if a bear comes onto your property, you're kind of encouraged to handle it yourself rather than calling Fish and Wildlife or, you know, Department of Natural Resources or whatever your local wildlife agency is. But those are few and far between, those states. For the most part, you're supposed to call the wildlife managers, the agency people, if you have an issue with an animal like that. But the guy in that I was shadowing in Aspen in Pitkin County, he said there's been situations where people have been sitting down at dinner and a bear just comes through the front door, grabs something off the table and leaves.
And
I mean, they don't always wait till you're out of town. Obviously, in a resort area, a lot of people are gone. There's a lot of empty houses, which is easy pickings for bears. I mean, it's very easy for them to pop open a window. And people, the building code there, you're not allowed to do French door handles because it's so easy to just push down and lean. And any bear can do that. They can also, a hollow doorknob, they just crush it in their teeth, turn it, push it in. So the actual building code is written with bears in mind. Automatic doors into ski resorts and hotels, sometimes they just walk off.
Walk in.
Walk in.
But didn't you say that they have the same kind of dexterity around cars where they're, because of their claws, they can just open, they don't even bother to smash a window. They can actually very deftly open up a door if they'd like to.
They can pop a door. I mean, I went up to the scene of a bear had just broken into a house up in the hills outside Aspen. And it just kind of had popped the window and then just pushed the screen through. The screen window was lying kind of bent on the floor, and the bear, it was a white carpet, didn't even leave any footprints, went up the stairs to the kitchen, didn't knock anything over, got to the fridge, created somewhat of a mess. The guy, he gives the business card to the housekeeper who's there because the family's out of town, and he says, you know, they can call this number if they want. And he said a lot of people don't because they know that bear is likely to get put down, which is why it's important to try to keep bears away from human food sources. But once they kind of learn, that's tough. You know, there's a lot of recidivism.
Yeah. Well, and so then back to India and the famous setup of I once shot an elephant in my pajamas. Do they allow, other than firecrackers, are they allowed firearms or that sort of thing to scare away the bears? What else do they have? I mean,
the elephants?
Yeah. Yeah. What do they have? Pots and pans?
You know what is interesting about elephants in India? People, they get upset that the elephants are coming in and eating the crops, and sometimes they go after the homebrew, the alcohol. Elephants like to drink, little-known fact. But when you talk to people, and they also, it doesn't take that much to get an elephant drunk. They don't have the enzyme, you know, to break it down.
Are they an easy drunk? are they as discriminating in their beer brands as they are in ice cream? You feel like bears won't drink Coors. They won't. Yeah. It's like too watery for them.
That's true. Bears do like beer, and they go for the premium brands. That is absolutely true. But the elephants, the elephants like the homebrew, the real rot gut homebrew stuff. I'm going off on a tangent because I'm so tired. I'm just babbling.
No, you're doing great. But that's so much of what I'm interested in, because like I had a problem with drunken deer when I lived in St. Paul, and they would eat the fermented fruit in the fall that would land on the ground. It would ferment, and then they'd come by. And ordinarily, I mean, deer in a community like the Twin Cities, they're like rats, right? They're like alley rats. They're everywhere. They come at night. They knock over your garbage cans. They're such a pain in the neck. And they always come in like groups of seven or eight. I mean, there's never just usually one. They come in, there's a buck, and then there's three, you know, does and whatever. So what I'm saying is there was a time when you just wouldn't see them. They're stealthy. But then during the fermented fruit season, they would literally be lying in the golf course across the street from my house in midday, having consumed a belly full of fermented fruit. And they'd be lying there, be like, hey, how's it going, man? They didn't care.
Same with the elephants. Somebody wrote a paper about alcohol and elephants, and they said, for the most part, they're kind of a gentle drunk. They tend to get drunk, and they wander off on their own and kind of sway back and forth and wrap their trunk around themselves and then like flop over and sleep it off. But every group has a mean drunk. It's often like a matriarch elephant or a male who's in must, which is like that hormonal tumult. And you don't want to be around a drunk male elephant in must.
No.
But
that's what I heard. I heard that about Babar, by the way. That he was a mean.
He was a mean drunk.
He was a mean drunk elephant. That wasn't in any of the stories, but that was. It came out at. I think TMZ had that in there. They reported
don't
on that.
Don't let the fat fool you.
Yeah, don't let that.
We have the cedar waxwings that come once a year, and they there's this huge berry bush in the next yard, and they get drunk on the berries, and they inevitably. I think they're kind of like the blue angels, you know, where one of them looks at the wings of the one next to it, and they're not all looking where they're going, because inevitably, once a year, we'll find a dead one on the deck. Because that's my theory, is that they fly in a flock, and you know how the blue angels never look where they're going? They look at the wing tip of the person next to them? This is my theory. But they're also, they're drunk.
Yeah.
And then they go and crap all over our car. And,
they do that on purpose.
It's part of the drunk. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like rock stars at a hotel. They just pick, you know, they do these kind of, kind of stuff just for pranks. The discussion about the elephants notwithstanding, because they, you know, they're big. They're not, may not be like rogue elephants in that way where they decide they like the taste of humans because they don't eat the humans. Bears will, right? There's the occasional rogue bear that will become a man eater that we know that happens from time to time. Not very often, but it does.
Occasionally, yes, it does occasionally. Yes, it's rare.
Yeah, I know. But I read that book, The Night of the Grizzly, about that attack. In 1967 in Montana, I think it was, where at Glacier.
Every now and then these animals behave in a really weird way. Like there was this mountain lion. I went to this conference. It doesn't matter what it was, but one of the guys, he's a Canadian wildlife officer, and he told this story about, you know, he's up in rural Canada. There's a lot of bears and a lot of mountain lions, cougars, and he gets this call from this couple, and they say, we are in our home, and this cougar is stalking us from outside. We are in the house, and he is circling the house and looking in the window, and the guy's like, you know, cougars don't stalk humans. So he drives out in his truck, and he pulls up, and he parks. He leaves his gun in the truck, and he goes up to the house, and the people are like waving at him like frantically. He looks around and there's the cougar. It's like ears flat, tail kind of switching, and it jumps on him. And first of all, he said you could see paw prints all over the windows. You know, like it was a serious situation, and it jumped him, and it was like he's yelling to the guy in the house, "I need a knife! I need a knife!" And the guy's like, "What kind of knife?" He's like, "A sharp knife." And the guy's like, "Oh, it's in the dishwasher."
Sharp knife. He's like, sharp
get knife. The knife.
What kind of knife? A butter knife.
So he, as he put it, he baits motels. I thought that was a good verb.
Yeah.
The cougar. And he survives. His leg is chewed up. But anyway, that is really unusual behavior. And they did a, autopsy, necropsy, they call it.
Necropsy,
on the animal.
Right.
And they found that the stomach was blocked. That there was a piece of a, like a sneaker, which suggests perhaps he'd eaten another person. But the thinking was the animal was starving because its stomach was blocked and it wasn't able to
digest food.
And so it was going after any.
It went mad.
Things.
Well, and they were never able, in the famous book, Night of the Grizzly, which was a very interesting book because it explained how, just to your point, prior to this at Glacier National Park, there had never been like a fatal attack ever. And that same night, two separate bears on the same night in two different parts of the park attacked humans who were doing nothing more than just sleeping in the woods.
I heard about this. Weren't they women?
Yeah, some of the victims were girls. Yeah, they were like 19, 21.
I heard about this. And this is where the rumor started that bears go after women who are having their period.
That
is not true. But that's where that started. That night. Yeah.
You tell that to Brick in Anchorman, because I think he's the one who's also been passing that rumor along for years, Steve Carell. All right, so and All right, we'll come back. We're coming up after a break. We'll get more from Mary Roach on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.